session. The Honorable Chief Justice Kelly is present.
Please be seated. For the cases we have on this morning, Justice Hardesty is not present. He will be listening to the tapes of the hearings, and he will be part of our deliberation as all three matters. The first matter on calendar is Danvers District Court. See our Title Services, Inc., 57020. If the parties are ready to proceed, please proceed. When you come to the podium, please state who you are and if you wish to reserve any time.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jacob Hafter for the petitioner. I'd like to respectfully reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the court, in response to an economic crisis, which has jeopardized the ownership of approximately one in every six homes in Nevada, during the last legislative session, a new law was passed that created a mechanism for the courts to interject themselves into what has traditionally been a non-judicial foreclosure process. While thousands have completed the program in the last year and a half or so, many homeowners and their counsel have traveled through the path of the program with uncertainty and perhaps intrepidation. Such concerns arise from the unexpected appearance of chasms, which have interrupted the smooth journey for some in the program. Today we come before you and ask this court to help close one of these chasms. And in doing so, we ask not only for a method across this issue, but that this court provide a path that maintains, if not strengthens, the integrity and efficiency of the program.
Why is a writ of prohibition appropriate here?
We filed a writ of prohibition, quite honestly, Your Honor, because we didn't know that we didn't see any other mechanism available. As the Supreme Court is responsible for the oversight and operations of the mediation program, what we were asking the court to do is to prohibit a second process from proceeding. And we believe that a writ of prohibition would be the best. As you are well aware, that a writ of prohibition is an extraordinary writ, which may be issued only in cases where there's not a plain, speedy, and adequate remedy.
So you're suggesting, notwithstanding the procedural posture of this case, but you're really suggesting that once you get one shot in the program, you never get another one.
Cutting down to it, yes, Your Honor. I think that what's interesting is some may say that this, if you approved our petition, if you granted it, it would create a draconian effect. I've heard the words of unconstitutional takings and the like being brought forth. What I'd like to remind the court is first of all, out of the thousands that went through the program, only a few. Resulted in the bank being found in bad faith. And moreover, it's completely within the bank's control whether or not they will be found in bad faith in the future. The burden is very low for the bank.
So all I have to do is stop paying on my house and be fortunate enough to get a lender who maybe doesn't have the documents at the time. Once we're through with that process, I get to keep my house and never pay again.
Well, I don't agree with that, Your Honor. I think that, first of all, there's nothing that prevents a bank from taking the time necessary to ensure it has the documents before it begins the judicial.
What if they're lost? What if they have to go to some extreme measures to produce or to find those documents? And moreover, I'm coming back to the same thing. I'm concerned about the fact that this program is designed to assist, as you so appropriately point out, assist homeowners and lenders in a difficult economic time. But you're saying that even if the homeowner continues in breach, or breaches again, if you will, that the lenders have no recourse?
I don't think breaches again is appropriate. I would think that breach again would start a new default under whatever security instrument, which would then properly allow a second notice of default to occur. Getting into the issues of res judicata and claim preclusion, I believe that what makes this applicable for res judicata is that the initial claim is that of the initial default, or the default by the homeowner. Because through the process, whether it's the mediator or if one of the parties elects to challenge the mediator's recommendations, the district court can then find the bank in bad faith. But it's all on that initial claim of default. So I don't think a second default would be
subsequent precluded. Is probably a better word.
But the other thing is the banks still have their rights under contract to pursue the claim of the debt from this mortgage. And we shouldn't forget that.
What do you mean by contract? What rights? What are you referring to?
Well, they could sue in court for a breach of contract.
Well, they have a one action rule. They have to go against the property and foreclose under NRS 40.430.
They can elect to go after a foreclosure on the process on the home. But my understanding is they could also, in lieu of foreclosing on the property, they could sue under breach of contract for the money damages as well. That is just one option. The other point that I'd like to...
I'd like to return to the procedural point of us being here on a writ of prohibition, and that's a statutory as well as constitutional procedure in Nevada. And both the statute and the case law on the constitutional provision talk about prohibition arresting the proceedings of a person, you know, a juridical person, exercising judicial functions. I have real trouble seeing that the foreclosure mediation program is exercising judicial functions. And if we don't have that, then we don't have prohibition. So can you tell me why you think prohibition is appropriate here?
Yeah, interestingly, in a case in federal court that I'm involved with just a week or so ago, a federal judge ruled that an ex parte telephone meeting of the Board of Medical Examiners was a judicial function. I think that the case law and
but that could be judicial or quasi-judicial in the sense of a licensing-type proceeding. But what we have here is an entirely, it's a mediation. It is not judicial in any sense, is it?
Well, I think it does judicial. I think it does have characteristics of the judicial process.
Primarily, what are they?
Primarily the fact that through the mediation process, and then including but not limited to the district court, ability to review under foreclosure mediation rule 6, we have the ability to experience sanctions as a result of our behavior in this mediation program. So it's not a complete non-binding mediation program that's just, you know, no harm, no foul, as we would see in a traditional ADR setting. It comes with very specific penalties and very specific authority. Those penalties can only be exercised by the authority of the judiciary.
Well, of course, you can appeal the judicial review.
As many do, and then that even more entwines this process into the judiciary. If there are no other questions, I'd like to...
I have a question. Let's assume for the sake of argument that prohibition were to be deemed appropriate. What you're asking this court to prohibit is to prohibit the notice of default to go forward on a new notice of default, presumably with new defaults. Or are you just saying that the notice of default should be prohibited as to the defaults that were the subject of the original one?
The latter, Your Honor.
Okay, so that's the only thing you're asking.
Correct. And again, that is a small segment of the people who've gone through the program. And moreover, it is completely within the control of the banks. Again, the hurdles to completing this program on behalf of the beneficiary are so low. All it is to provide the documents, which, as an aside, getting back to an earlier point, NRS 107.085, I believe, or thereabout, has a provision for what happens if the beneficiary has lost their documents. They're allowed to use documents that are in the assessor's office, or the recorder's office. And so all they need to do is present those documents and then present with somebody who has authority. And quite honestly, Your Honor, if they don't have the authority or they don't have the documents, then they shouldn't be taking somebody's home if they can't prove that.
Let me ask you this. Do you concede then, and I'm just asking the next follow-up question. Do you concede that if a new default, that they're free to reinitiate proceedings?
Absolutely, and I think I already made that point clear. I think that the res judicata issues apply because the second NOD in this case came from the original default of the homeowner. If the homeowner would have turned around, made payments, became current, and then stopped paying their mortgage again, creating a secondary default, then I think that a new notice of default would be appropriate. And I think it would be equitable. But getting back to that authority issue, I would really request this court look at that, especially in light of what's coming out right now in the news. I mean, I got a significant number of calls Monday morning about that 60 Minutes piece where
but
that was Hafter, just this week.
Do you believe everything you see on television or just part of it?
No, Your Honor, but I could tell you that I've dealt with those documents and those type of recordings as well in other
That's
cases.
That's not a part of our record here.
And it's not part of this record, but this record does deal with the issue of authority.
And I want to be sure I understood something that you said earlier in response to a question that Justice Pickering asked you. You said that you felt that the second filing of the notice of default could or should be interpreted as a judicial or quasi-judicial proceeding. Is that correct?
I said that the second filing of the notice would be a new, it would be a new process, it would be a new claim.
Okay, so you did not say that it was judicial or quasi-judicial in character, such that would give rise to a five-star analysis.
I believe that the entire process, once a homeowner elects to mediate, that homeowner is bringing that foreclosure into the auspice of the judiciary.
We notice that you've elected to reserve some time. You still have 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Justices. My name is Greg Hubley. I represent the real parties in interest here, City Mortgage and CR Title Services. Respectfully, I honestly could not disagree more with my opponent's opening brief and reply in this case. And I think that the paperwork that he's filed with this court, the whole perspective seems to revolve around the issue of punishment. But the Nevada legislature didn't pass AB 149 to punish lenders or homeowners. It passed that law to arrange for a speedy process of mediation before foreclosure to allow the parties to get together and talk about available options other than foreclosure.
Why can't we have an expectation that before you file a notice of default that you'll have the paperwork? I mean, we demand that of plaintiffs in medical malpractice cases to have an affidavit of a doctor saying that malpractice has been committed. Why can't we expect under the system that you have your ducks in order, that you have somebody ready with authority, and that you have your documents, and then feel free to file your notice of default?
Absolutely, Your Honor. That can be expected, and it is expected, and there are sanctions that apply when it's not dealt with. They can be in the form of monetary sanctions. They can be in the form of an order, which is most often the case, that the certificate of completion not issue, which requires the process to start all over again.
Well, how many bad faiths before something should happen? Like, well, you file a second notice of default immediately after the first notice of default has been, or the first mediation fails, and there's bad faith again, and maybe a third time there's bad faith. What should we do as jurists in this community?
The way that the statute was drafted and the way that the rules were enacted, or I should say adopted by this court, do not limit that number. They simply say that you need the lender has to have a certificate to foreclose in order to proceed. They do not address, and I would say they do not address that intentionally, the number of times, because it's not contemplated by the statute right now that you only get a one-shot chance at this.
Well, I know in construction defect we had mandatory mediation, mandatory settlement conferences, and I know some district court judge in Department 18 sanctioned somebody so bad that after that we always had people with authority because they were afraid not to have authority. So, I mean, is that what we need to do, to tell Judge Mosley and Judge Flanagan just sanction the hell out of these lenders and then, like a certain district judge did in Department 18, and that's the way we'll establish it? So we won't have this problem again. We won't see writs of prohibition, which Believe me, we can't afford to hear all these writs of prohibition that we're going to get from foreclosure mediation or appeals. We just can't afford it. We don't have a court of appeals, and it's just the seven of us listening to 82 district judges.
I understand.
Which leads me to a question that dovetails on this. Before we ever get to the number of times that a notice of default or the foreclosure mediation process could or should proceed, should we even be hearing this on the writ of prohibition? What is it that procedurally brings this properly before the court? I believe that my colleagues have asked that question of the appellant. I'd like to hear your position.
Thank you, Your Honor. And that's a great question. And quite frankly, a writ of prohibition is not an available remedy in this case for, and I'll explain why. There's a number of reasons. There are adequate remedies at law here. And as the justices pointed out, or at least suggested, I should say, in the discussion with my opponent, the action in recording and serving a notice of default is not a judicial action. It simply is not. And the foreclosure mediation administrator's office does not act in a judicial function when they do that, when they simply assign a matter to mediation. It is absolutely, in essence, a ministerial task. There's no weighing of evidence. There's no testimony presented. It's just a matter of the homeowner has elected to participate in mediation. The homeowner has submitted this election form to the mediation administrator, and the homeowner has paid his fee. Therefore, under both the statute and the Nevada Foreclosure Mediation Program rules, the administrator has no discretion. He or she has to assign it to mediation.
Let me ask you this. Given Mr. Hafter's concession that if there are fresh defaults encompassed in the notice of default, there the second mediation can go forward, etc., are there fresh defaults in your second notice of default, or are you simply reinitiating the notice as to the exact same defaults, nothing more, nothing different?
Reinitiating the default as to the exact same default that was previously addressed in the original notice of default.
Are there additional defaults?
Well, I
is it a failure to make monthly payments? So there are additional payments that came due and haven't been paid that are encompassed by the second notice of default?
Absolutely, that would be a part of the second default. But the first default is, as I'm sure the justices are aware, 99.9% of the time based upon a failure to make payments. Once this goes through a mediation, if the mediator or the court on a petition for judicial review determines that a letter of certification will not issue, a subsequent notice of default would most certainly seek the payments that were in default at the time of the original notice of default, as well as those that had accrued since that time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so I want to understand, we don't have a situation where we have to even decide this issue, because if you have fresh notice, fresh defaults, each time a payment is due and not made, there's a default. This is not a case where the homeowner has picked up and started making the payments post conclusion of the first mediation.
That's correct. And
so you do have new defaults encompassed in your notice of default.
In the second notice of default?
Yes.
Yes, it would encompass the amounts that had accrued since the original notice.
But let me clarify that, though. Your notice of default and election to sell, which is recorded, says the date of the breach and when the payments defaulted. So what I think you did is you not only included the old payments, you included some new ones. So it's a mix of both the prior ones which were addressed in the mediation and new defaults, then. Is that correct?
I think you're correct. That would more accurately characterize it, Your Honor.
Okay, so would injunctive relief be appropriate then if it includes old defaults which are the subject of the mediation and no certificate's been issued?
You know, that's a tough question for me to answer. I think it would be on a case-by-case basis. I don't think we can say that injunctive relief in every case where there's a subsequent notice of default should or should not be granted. I think that it's certainly up to the discretion of the district courts to make that determination, and by all means, I think that the homeowners following the mediations or the petitions for judicial review have every right and every option to file a motion for preliminary.
Well, I just wanted to clarify that because I think Justice Peregrine brought up initially is the writ of prohibition the right legal vehicle to address this. In our next case, we're going to argue there is an injunction issue in that one. So I just want to get your perspective on what's the proper legal vehicle to challenge this.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. And I'm going to do my best to address as summarily as I can the writ of prohibition and the other reasons for which it's not applicable. I think that in the opening brief and the reply that was filed by the petitioner here, he concedes that there could have been an action filed with the district court. And by action, I mean lawsuit. I mean a civil action for damages or equitable relief. He concedes that, but he says, essentially, I'm paraphrasing, of course, under the Collins decision, I can't file an action for wrongful foreclosure because the petitioner is in default, and I can't file an abuse of process claim because it's reasonable to believe that the real parties in interest here were merely trying to secure their property interest, their collateral. But the point I want to emphasize is that the absence of a legitimate claim for relief in district court, or the fact that it might be a tough claim to prove, that doesn't automatically give a party a right to seek a writ of prohibition and seek extraordinary relief on an original petition to this court. Nor does it warrant invoking this court's jurisdiction to talk about changing the language that's in the statute. And I think Mr. Hafter's conceded that there is a heavy burden to demonstrate that intervention by way of extraordinary relief is required. And this court has held consistently that it's not going to get into writs of prohibition unless there's a usurpation or abuse of power. There must be a clear excess or absence of jurisdiction. And again, getting back to what the foreclosure mediation program administrator did in this case, I just can't see how that can realistically be argued to be acting in excess or absence of jurisdiction. To the contrary, what the foreclosure administrator, mediation administrator did here was followed a specific statutory charge that when you get an election to mediate, you will assign this a mediator, and it will go into mediation. The foreclosure administrator isn't weighing evidence. He or she is not determining whether or not anything other than an election to mediate has been filed and the fee has been paid. They have no discretion. There just is not a realistic or legitimate argument that the program administrator exceeded or acted without jurisdiction.
Now, so what you're saying is we really have to count on our district judges to do the proper thing and then let the lenders come up here on appeals rather than writs of prohibition from the borrowers.
Well, I think that you're absolutely right that the district court, which is why the statute and the rules from this court allow the district court discretion to review these and allow the district court to modify to impose sanctions as the district court seems appropriate. That's what it is there to do. And if a party disagrees with the determination of the district court, of course, they have relief to come up here on appeal. But yes, that is the intent of, as I read it, both the statute and the rules of this court, the Nevada Foreclosure Mediation Program rules, I should say, is that the district court will hear disputes related to the mediations that occurred under the Foreclosure Mediation Program. I want to also address the claim preclusion issue. I know it was brought up when Mr. Hafter was discussing his brief. That is not an applicable issue to raise here because it's specifically limited, and it's limited to preventing litigation. It's limited to precluding parties from relitigating issues that they could have raised in a prior action. And I emphasize those words, litigation, relitigating, and action, because that's what it's all about. And a non-judicial foreclosure, as its name suggests, is a wholly non-judicial act. Even a petition for judicial review really doesn't contain actual legal claims, as I think it would apply when you're talking claim preclusion. And the fact that the legislature required mediations prior to foreclosure in AB 149 doesn't magically transform the act of noticing a default into litigation, nor does it transform mediation at which no evidence is taken, no testimony is provided, only a mediator's statement comes out of that. Claim preclusion just doesn't apply here.
Why doesn't it apply to the district court's determination that no certification letter will be issued and the imposition of that as a sanction to the defaults that were the subject of the first notice?
That's an excellent question, Your Honor, and what I'll do is refer to the prior petition for judicial review that occurred in this case. And Judge Mosley's decision on that petition for judicial review, it denied only the issuance of a letter of certification as it applied to the petition before him, as it applied to the mediation that had occurred previously. The subsequent notice of default that followed, it's not an action. It's a private contractual right that's not based upon the same claims that Judge Mosley adjudicated. It's based upon the fact that the lender says there's a default and we're going to exercise our right by foreclosing. Judge Mosley didn't address that. What Judge Mosley addressed in the petition for judicial review in this case was, are sanctions appropriate, and am I not going to issue a letter of certification? And the notice of default that followed that, the second notice of default, it's not based upon the imposition of sanctions. It's not based upon whether or not a letter of certification should issue from the first proceeding. It's based upon the contractual right to foreclose. So the elements in Five-Star, the third of which is that the subsequent action is based upon the same claims or any part of them that were or could have been brought in the first case, it's absolutely missing here. It's not there. So, frankly, and with all due respect, claim preclusion does not apply. The last issue that I wanted to discuss, it was raised by this court in the order of March 15th, and basically whether, I think it dovetails onto what I've already been saying, but it's whether or not a second foreclosure, a second notice of default can be issued after a letter of certification was denied. I will just say in summary fashion that the statute does not give any guidance, does not state, I should say, that this is a one-shot deal. You get one-shot lenders. If you don't do it, then you're never going to be able to foreclose. I would submit to the court there's a lot of good policy reasons why the legislature didn't include such language, but the fact is it didn't. This court didn't in its rules, and that's the law that we have before us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Any questions before he sits down? Mr. Hafter.
Thank you once again. First of all, what's interesting is Mr. Hubley suggests that the Nevada legislature didn't pass the law to punish lenders. Well, what's very interesting is NRS 107.0865 talks about sanctions against lenders. It doesn't have anywhere in this section sanctions against homeowners. And I find that very telling that the legislature did impose sanctions against lenders, or the authority to issue those, but was silent with respect to sanctions against homeowners. With respect to the notice of default issue, I'd like to clarify something that Mr. Hubley said as well. And he said that the second notice of default is for new breaches. Well, what's interesting is if you read the original breach, notice of default, the way they define breach is a default beginning on a certain date and continuing with all subsequent failures to pay timely payments. Okay, so that the way that they define the breach on the first notice of default would encompass the same breach that the notice of default filed on the second time in this case it was defined as well. With respect to a judicial task, whether or not this is a judicial task, I'd like to ask the court to, remind the court what it said in Stockmeyer versus Nevada Department of Corrections, 122 Nevada 385, where, there were four elements that were really the heart of that were put forth. Was there a written finding? Is there evidence, testimony provided? Representation of counsel at the hearing? And is there a right to appeal? We have all of those in this case.
As to the judicial review piece of it, not as to the mediation piece.
Well, we have that in the judicial review, but we also...
Well, that would suggest that you have a right of direct appeal from the end point in the judicial review proceeding, not an original writ of prohibition to this court.
But the problem is, what happens when the second notice of default is filed? At the time, it was 16 days, you know, 60 or more than 30 days now, because you have 30 days now to appeal, I think. There was a rule change. But what happens when that time extends beyond that, and they just have the second notice of default 2 months afterwards or 3 months afterwards, and I don't have a right to appeal anymore on that second notice of default? So I don't think we could say that with absolute certainty. With respect to whether or not, I mean, the real issue here is this a terminal process or is it a circular process? And of course they're going to argue it's circular because they don't want to have to do their homework before they begin this process, and they don't care if homeowners have to go through this over and over again.
So isn't it true, though, that for every month subsequent to the initial breach, as you suggested, stated in the first notice of default, that unless there's a payment or some type of remedy by the homeowner, that there is a new breach of the agreement every time a payment is due?
No, the way that they define the notice of default, the way that they define the breach is a failure to pay under the note beginning on, I think in this case it was March 1st, 2009, and continuing with all subsequent missed payments from here on out.
The acceleration clause.
Yeah.
Correct. And so I don't believe that, you know, if I filed a second notice of default now on September 1st, 2009, saying now there's more added on to what was already, included. It's acceleration. I'd like to make one final point. I think that this court has the power, if they deem that a writ of prohibition is not appropriate, at the very least they consider it as an extraordinary writ and still consider the merits that we're asking, the issues nonetheless.
Chief, could I ask you a question, Mr. Hafter? Kind of following up on the mechanics of the notice of default and election to sell, and I agree with you, that's how they're normally phrased, but if you had a mediation on covering, let's say, March to June payments and then no certificate was issued, but then the borrower defaulted July 1st on the next payment, why couldn't you have a new notice of default recorded same July 1st? You know, you can't use the old payments, but you can use the new payments that have accrued since the adjudication by the court on the mediation.
So I'm sorry, I don't understand. Are you suggesting that the bank would forego collecting?
Well, I'm just saying that they can't. It wouldn't be the subject of their notice of default, you know, like that. Couldn't it be done that way?
I would assume if the claim for the default amount is different in the second notice of default than the first notice of default, then it would be a different default. But with the acceleration, right, as long as there's an ongoing continuous breach and it hasn't been cured or remedied by the homeowner, then I think that regardless if you file 1, 2, or 8, it's all the same default as defined.
Okay. Thank you.
Court would like to thank both counsels for the arguments this morning. As was noted previously, these are matters of first impression as the foreclosure mediation program, so that's why we scheduled an oral argument to give you a chance to give us additional information and to explain your positions. With that, we thank you very much.
Submitted.
It is submitted.